Hello and welcome to this week's edition of It's the Economy from KGNU Denver, Boulder, Fort Collins. I'm your host, Claudia Cragg. The 46th President of the United States, Joseph Biden, has unveiled a massive coronavirus relief package. It's a roughly $2 trillion plan for improving the nation's infrastructure and shifting to green energy over the next 8 years. Dubbed the American Jobs Plan, it's meant to be an opening move in what's expected to be a months-long negotiation with Congress. Few doubt that the nation's infrastructure is sorely in need of repair. It recently earned a C score from the American Society of Civil Engineers. But Biden is also pitching this plan as an investment to benefit communities of color, rural Americans, and others burdened by decay or lagging modernization. The president plans to pay for this part of his recovery package by raising corporate taxes, a core campaign promise that he made that he says would raise more than $2 trillion over the next 15 years. To get an opinion on this for our KGNU Denver Boulder community, we speak now with Eric J. Clark. You can reach him on Twitter at Eric, E-R-I-K, J, and Clark with an E. Clark is involved in the Catalyst Society of the Mile High United Way initiative, working on combating poverty in the Greater Denver area, including in the Strategic Investment Grants Committees to pay for programs for a variety of nonprofits focused on children and youth. He's also involved with the Denver Health Foundation on public health issues. Eric J. Clark. So, Eric Clark, we're speaking to you today, and I'm very interested, obviously, in your comments on COVID and healthcare. But it seemed to me that you would be a good person to speak to about the new infrastructure bill. And what, to you, is your first reaction of the $2 trillion infrastructure and jobs plan that President Biden rolled out?
That it's much needed. My first response to both the American Rescue Plan and the infrastructure bill is that both are much needed. If we look back historically at the 2008 and 2009 response to the banking crisis, looking at the American Reinvestment Act in 2009, the one key criticism that we saw as to why it didn't have a larger impact on the overall economy was that it wasn't large enough, and it was quickly followed up by sequestration and 2013. So the combination of not being large enough and having those pretty immediate government limitations, government shutdown, spending cuts limited that tail end effect of the economic growth. So as I look at this new response to the pandemic, the American Rescue Plan being much larger and broader, as well as this infrastructure plan, I think this is exactly what's needed for the economy. And looking forward, I don't know about most folks, but looking back at 2018 and 19, our economy was not in a great state of health at the time. Yes, the stock market was growing. The wealthy were becoming much wealthier. I'm not a big fan of the stock market as a leading indicator for economic health. The middle class and working class largely were still falling behind in those years. We had the student loan crisis had not been responded to for a very long time. Environmental impact, racial inequity, growing income gap between middle class, working class, and the very wealthy had been growing. So this combination of the American Rescue Plan and the infrastructure bill are much needed for all of those reasons.
You referred to 2018. It was like the administration then was papering over the cracks, I would say. Don't you think, Eric Clark, that the problem is the sheer numbers? Most people cannot understand $2 trillion, especially when minimum wages are still so low, even with an increase. Tell me about the attitude that people have, because the numbers are so big, that they just sort of, on one hand, either just say it's too much, go away, government can't be doing this, we'll be bankrupt. And other people's attitude that they think it's probably a very good idea, but because of the sheer size of the numbers, they refuse to engage.
Yeah, one, the minimum wage is too low. I especially the federal minimum wage. I completely agree. It hasn't been updated in a very long time. I was disappointed to see that it didn't make the final bill of the American Rescue Plan. I hope to see a standalone bill, and I'm glad to see states on a state-by-state level responding to increased minimum wages because it's much needed. In terms of the size of the infrastructure bill, it's a big bill, but we have big challenges. The deferred maintenance in this country on bridges and critical infrastructure and our energy grid system, which is a big piece of this as well, have not gone resolved in decades. We have crumbling bridges. We just had a crisis recently in the state of Texas regarding the energy grid system. And we're not so far removed from potential crises here in Colorado. Updating our very dated energy grid system, which hasn't received a major update, by the way, since the 1970s, to smart grid technology is not just important for all people, no matter middle class, wealthy, working class. It's critical for our long-term success as a country.
How would you persuade people who are against public finance versus private finance?
First of all, you can do both. It's not totally unreasonable to expect that government can partner with the private sector on problem solving and especially on innovation. But when you look at these public goods, especially infrastructure, there is a significant market gap. When you're talking about building roads and bridges and these public good issues, when the private sector can't make profit off of any kind of function, it's the role and responsibility of the government to step in and meet that obligation. We can't go without roads. We can't go without transit systems and bridges and energy. In this 21st century, we can't go without internet access. It's a huge equity issue, not just in urban and suburban areas, but rural as well. So when the private sector would not or cannot respond to a need of the people, then government has a responsibility to do that, or at the very least close the gap and work with constructively with the private sector on solving problems.
One of the things the new plan covers is public school upgrades and training for clean energy workforce. Why are those important in the greater picture?
Even here in Colorado, we have public schools that are falling apart, especially if you look at rural Colorado. I mean, rural Colorado, many of these communities don't have the economic financial resources due to lower payroll tax collection, or excuse me, property tax collection. Don't have the capabilities to upgrade school systems, especially in the 21st century when we're looking at the digital being a much bigger piece of the education landscape. The cost of education is generally increasing, and the ability to respond in terms of expenditures is rather limited. This infrastructure bill is wide in scope, and it should be wide in scope. It should include these core infrastructure, transportation, energy expenditures, as well as meeting these needs that have gone just so far unaddressed in the long term, including education.
Well, you did mention profit, and you did say that you believe public and private can work together. A large part of this is $115 billion. Which is not a huge amount out of trillions, would pay for fixing roads and bridges chosen by those most in need of repair. What that brings up, Eric, is the sourcing of those bridges and roads that need to be repaired, then who the contracts go to. Isn't that also where a lot of problems occur in public financing of large projects like this?
It is. Whenever you have any large spending priority, whether it be this infrastructure bill or looking back at the 2009 American Reinvestment Act that included a lot of infrastructure as well, one piece is this deferred maintenance is $115 billion, we're talking about, when we say deferred maintenance, we're talking about critical condition roads and bridges. I remember back, it had to be 2 decades ago now, when the bridge collapsed in Minnesota, a bridge that had gone without repair. It becomes not just a transportation issue, but a real public safety issue as well. Pick a community. There's deferred maintenance across this country, unfortunately.
But people say, oh, look, we can put off bridges because they're doing just fine. And the overhanging debt has a serious consequence for our children and our children's children. That is the opposition point of view, not mine. What do you say to the people who say no debt at any price? In fact, it always goes with the same model that it insists growth at any price. So you have to have eternal growth and you have to have no debt, neither of which are achieved. Why do people need to understand that debt must be incurred and it is not unmanageable? You, as an auditor who looks at balancing books, what comes in, what goes out, how do you explain why it is necessary to incur this debt?
First of all, the best way, the most effective way at paying off the federal debt and reducing the deficit, as we've seen in the 1990s, is by growing the economy. And not only do we need to grow this economy, but this economy is not equitable. It is limited, and it is suffering under this pandemic and this recession and these, we talk about deferred maintenance, these deferred challenges that we face as a country. So one, I would argue that growing the economy is the best way to reduce the deficit and pay off the federal debt. Or reduce the federal debt. And our economy certainly needs the help right now. Looking towards, I believe the size of the bill is a concern of some of the conservative movement. But you look at the size of the tax cuts by the previous administration that largely went to major corporations paying $0 tax bills to the American taxpayer, to the federal government. Or super wealthy individuals. We're talking about billionaires, not middle class folks or even upper middle class folks. We're talking about multi-billionaires who have much smaller tax burdens than your average middle class person. Not just in terms of rate of their percentage of their income, but in terms of standard of living and their ability to operate within the economy. If we really want an apples to apples paradigm between these priorities, the infrastructure bill, and the recent tax cuts, then I think it's there.
So by stimulating the economy with the engine driver that this package is, that grows the economy, creates jobs, not to mention green jobs, and ultimately that will pay back the expenditure, is the belief, correct?
Correct. And I would say more than payback, because a lot of these crises that this bill responds to are crises that will have to be responded to at some point.
Now, we've mentioned, I've skirted COVID deliberately at this point, because I personally believe that in this one instance, COVID has brought about this package, which was very much needed, which has now made it essential. Now, you are a community service leader in many areas of health with the Denver Health Foundation and Mile High United Way. The COVID part of our discussion so far, it is very significant. It is probably not a passing pandemic. And even if it is, the consequences of it will be felt for a long time to come.
COVID is also a catalyst for a lot of these worsening economic crises. We had many economic issues that had gone unaddressed prior to COVID. I would call it a powder keg. I actually wrote an article back in October 2019, before COVID had even been on anyone's radar, about having a powder keg of unaddressed economic issues, and that all it required for a real recession or even a depression was a spark. Now, I don't think most economists or most observers would have said that a global pandemic would have been that spark, but here we are. So I do think that COVID as a standalone has been a real significant challenge, not just for our economy, but for our families and communities as well. But I would say that COVID-19 was a spark for an already existing powder keg. And we have a, not just a responsibility, but a moral obligation to respond and to fix these issues that have plagued our society, our economy, and our communities for decades.
Equity in Society program as a whole has covered the impact that COVID has had disproportionately on those most hard-pressed in the United States. Now, the healthcare part of this, we've had healthcare workers on all talking about the appalling situation they're in, coping mentally, coping with their lives amidst dealing with everybody during the pandemic. What is not discussed, Eric, and you might have some insight because of your work with Denver Health Foundation, is the impact, financial impact, on health providers. It has occurred to me that many health providers are actually losing money. They're not getting all the hip replacements in the same quantity, the doctor visits in the same quantity. Have you given any thought to the sustainability of the health provision model as it has been to this point?
I would add to that that there's also been a real challenge in both urban and rural healthcare, not just on the provider side, but with accessibility to care and not just your adjacent care, but primary care work, really critical care for some of these communities on the ground. And part of that is the gap in coverage. When you have a significant, it's called the donut hole, you don't quite make enough money to afford health care on your own, or your employer doesn't provide it. And you don't make little enough money to qualify for enough government assistance. So one, those provider rates, I think, need to be looked at as a whole. But the gap in coverage is also a significant issue. The fact of the matter is we need to, as a country, reach universal coverage, not just as a moral issue, but as a core economic issue. This is a program about economics, so that our healthcare system can function to its full capacity. I've been a big proponent of universal health care. I've been advocating for the Joe Biden's public option proposal, which will make a big difference. It's a big step in the right direction. And I think that's a critical piece of the conversation as well.
But we haven't taken the Bernie Sanders route, and many cannot understand why.
From a political standpoint, I guess the votes don't exist. I'm fully in favor of any strong positive step in the right direction when you're talking about millions of people getting coverage who had no coverage, and tens of millions of people who don't receive enough coverage now getting up to a level where they can be a real consumer of healthcare. I think that's it's a big step in the right direction, and it's the minimum of what we need, and it should have been included, a decade ago with Obamacare. But I'm fully in favor of getting there eventually, and especially fighting for that universal coverage as well.
Now, we've just had Cesar Chavez Day, and I know that you took part in watched the community town hall. Do you feel we're reaching some new understanding of the inequity in society for Hispanics, for anyone other than white people? It is a very inequitable society. Do you hear that people in the Denver community, the Colorado community, the American community can see hope based on some of the things we've discussed so far? Or do you think they realize there's still 70 million people who frankly don't give a damn?
We are an incredibly divided society. I do recognize that along the Front Range of Colorado and Denver and Boulder and Fort Collins, I think that equity and understanding of equity has grown drastically, even over the last few years. The fact of the matter is there is a cultural divide in this country, and there are a lot of people out there who do not value equity. In terms of actually addressing inequities in our society, at its very core is that we don't necessarily track the data very well. Even at the local level, talking about equity auditing, we haven't been historically very good about tracking data, tracking disparities in programs. Everything from economic development opportunity programs to something as simple as trash collection. We don't track that data very well. And if you don't understand the data and you don't understand what's happening on the ground, the performance management piece, it is really hard to address those inequities. We can do much better.
And given that Colorado is not just a split state politically, it's often called purple. The truth is it's also a rural versus urban society. What kind of programs, Eric? As an auditor, again, I want to underscore, you're a man who understands balancing of payments, balancing of books. As with your auditor background, what initiatives could be implemented quickly to unite and to at least minimize the divide between urban and rural?
And that divide exists not just across this country, but across this world. If you look even internationally, there's a significant cultural divide between rural and urban communities. That's just true across the board. The fact of the matter is our investment in rural America, rural Colorado, needs to be much more robust. Everything from, we talk about infrastructure and schools, but broadband, the internet is the great equalizer, as they say. I fully favor much greater broadband. We look at satellite internet and the improving technologies there as well. Those core systems, access to knowledge and information and communication and telehealth and economic opportunity, that is really the great equalizer. And I think at its very core, that should be an incredibly important and focused and targeted part of any rural program.
You've been very noticeable in your very productive calls in terms of actually getting it out there that America should have a centralized single source for COVID-19 data. Now, this, of course, comes out of a political situation with states' rights. For your Denver Health and Mile High United Way thinking, what about that? It seems we're creating a tremendous vulnerability as though COVID recognized states and doesn't cross them, and therefore they can all independently manage what is a global situation.
Just this morning, I was reading about Florida and their data integrity. That we're not even sure if we can rely on Florida's case and death numbers due to COVID-19. So when you can't even rely on source data on a state-by-state level, then it becomes exceptionally difficult to analyze that data and manage according to it. If you're attempting to make management decisions or program or policy decisions, whatever it may be, without having data to rely on that you can rely on, then you're making those decisions in the dark. So at its very core, the lack of complete data across this country, the lack of accurate data that you can rely on, creates a huge management burden. We talk about equity, the lack of equity data as well. It could very well lead to a lack of full and robust management decision making. So I've been a big advocate of consolidating data in a central position at the federal government, as well as querying this federal response. When we look back at Ebola or swine flu or prior concerns, the centralized federal response, federal data, and allowing the federal government to drive the decision making, as well as coordinating with the international community, was incredibly effective. There's no reason we shouldn't do the same here.
We've had a very wide-ranging discussion deliberately, Eric, and I hope people will follow you on Twitter at Eric J. Clark, E-R-I-K, J. Clark with an E, Eric J. Clark. And the final question, you oversaw the budget for Denver Arts and Venues, and we, all of us, were thrilled this week about the opening of Red Rocks. Why is expenditure for the public arts so vital to the good of a community as whole, both mental and economic?
Easy. Art is culture. That's our legacy. Art is culture. When we talk about American diplomacy, a surprisingly big piece of that is American culture, the art we produce, the music, the physical art, across the digital art, across the board. It's why the United States is a great place. I mean, it's a core. Our art is a core reason why we are a great country. And it's a core reason why people value the United States. And the opening of Red Rocks was was great news to me, both from a financial expenditure perspective. Red Rocks is a big fund generator for arts and venues in the city of Denver through those ticket sales and concessions and all that good stuff. But also reestablishing that art as well in our community.
Eric Clark, thank you very much indeed for speaking to It's the Economy here at KGNU Denver, Boulder, Fort Collins.
Thanks for having me.